Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we have Peter Frankopan talking about the Silk Roads.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you very much. There's nothing nicer when you stand up on a stage to see lots and lots of people. But I do know that it's quality, not quantity. The first time I ever gave a lecture at Harvard, three people turned up, which was fine until you realise that one was the head of the history faculty, one was the dean of the humanities, and one was the professor in my specific subject, which was terrifying. So thank you for not just being here and giving up your Sunday afternoon, but for what I understand from the organisers and the sponsors, the best single crowd that the festival has seen, you in this tent. That's what I heard. That's what John told me. I should also add my thanks to the festival sponsors, the Daily Mail, and above all, I'd like to give a proper thank you to Jane Pladel Bouverie and to Rachel Holland. I can tell you, running a bunch of undergraduates is hard. Doing these kind of festivals, the organisation that goes into it, and the good humour, despite the mud, despite all the traffic and so on, I'm incredibly grateful. These are like miniature undergraduate courses, where in the course of 2 days or 3 days, you can garner as much information about history as you can possibly want or need to keep you going for ages. So thank you to them, and thank you for inviting me here today. So I'm going to talk a bit about the Silk Roads. And the Silk Roads, you'll know, are everywhere at the moment. And I'll show you a little bit why they're everywhere, if my slides work. So every time you pick up the newspaper at the moment, well, maybe not at the moment, there are other things going on that fill up all the pages. And I mean, you couldn't make it up, is all I can say. The Silk Roads are the other big story in the world other than Brexit. And they have been for some time. So behind me, I'm showing some of the headlines that just keep mentioning the regularity of Silk Roads in various publications about this new world that is being formed, new connections being formed across the spine of Asia, generally led by China, but in cooperation with all sorts of neighbouring powers that span between, well, Europe, let's face it, and the Pacific coast of China, the creation of a new set of Silk Roads. It's happening out of most people's eyesight, because here in Britain, I'll say something about that too, we have no, that's peripheral to us, it doesn't look important, and if it was important, someone would be saying that it was. But there is enough going on here to recognise that Silk Roads are doing everything. And the people who know most about what's going on in the world, really, of course, are fashion, is the fashion world. This behind me, I'm not even joking, this is the Kobe Bryant Nike Silk Road trainer, limited edition. When I spoke to Nike and I said, look, I got a book, you know, I don't know if anyone's going to read it, but if it becomes, let's say, number one bestseller, any chance you could give me some of these, because I could point to them instead of my muddy shoes here. These are inspired, Kobe Bryant is a basketball player in the United States. These trainers are inspired by the connections of traders over millennia across the ancient Silk Routes. So I don't know if he's here today, Kobe Bryant. But anyway, so he knows that the Silk Roads mean something, that you sell trainers based on the Silk Roads. You sell perfume. This is Hermès. You can't probably see it. Poivre Saint-Marcand. For those ladies in their life who like to spice things up, this is the top seller at the moment for Hermès to make your husband smell like the great ancient spice markets of Central Asia. And having just come back from Central Asia, where I came back smelling of, I was offered as a distinguished visitor, of course, fermented horse milk, which is a great speciality. But because of my book, I think because I'm trying to talk about a world that there's a real fascination with history, I was offered camel milk from a particularly aged mare as a sign of my distinction. And I can tell you, I don't think that anyone really probably wants to smell like that. But anyway, Poivre Saint-Marcand, Hermès, shops near you now. And probably the single great, I'm not even joking, probably the best bellwether of what is going on in the world. We talked about him a bit on Friday night. Well, I talked about him a bit. We talked about him on Friday night, for those of you who are there. This man knows more than anyone how to detect what's... the Silk Roads, yes, okay. Anyway, in the world is Vladimir Putin here modelling his James Bond villain look. Last summer, instead of chillaxing in Ibiza, our Prime Minister likes to chillax, our new Prime Minister, who knows what they'll do on their in their summer holidays. But Putin said that he wasn't going to take a holiday and said he was going to spend the summer by the Black Sea, which he's done for the last few years. He never tells you it's because he's got a billion-dollar residence there. 3 or 4 years ago, he went scuba diving and came up after 20 minutes with two perfectly formed 3rd century BC amphorae. He's got a lot of things. But last summer, he said he was going to spend the summer looking at the ancient sites of the Silk Road in Russia. And in his State of the Union address, he said what people really need to read was about the Silk Roads, which you can't quite believe that sort of thing happening. Putin, fashion houses, basketball players, economists are seeing something proper being knitted together across part of the world that we pay almost no attention to. And those of you who are here today to hear about the Silk Roads, I'm going to show you some pictures. When we talk about it, we tend to call it the Silk Road. I know that there will be travel agents here, but there is no Silk Road. It's sloppy, there's no such term, there's no such phrase. It just gets used to sell people stuff that they don't really want or need. Because there isn't such a thing, and it's complicated to call it the Silk Road. The Silk Road, in the singular, suggests there's a start point and an end point. That suggests there's one sort of motorway that rides across the whole spine of Asia. And there isn't. The term was coined in the 19th century. We academics get very pedantic about lots of things, but it's important to be accurate. They were called the Seidenstrassen by Ferdinand von Richthofen, who was the... History has a funny way of making these connections. He was the uncle of the Red Baron. This idea that there are multiple roads is very important because it goes without saying, I suppose, that when there is goods coming in one direction, something goes back the other way. So all of you who bought a burger today, you get your burger and then the person behind the till gets some money. And what happens to that money, what happens to goods traded in different directions is fundamentally important. And the Silk Road, in a singular, gives this idea that there is something always going east to west. Actually, things that go west to east are very important, and also north-south, south-north. So sorry about that. If anybody wants to go on a Silk Road tour, make the agents work hard and say you'll only go if they call it the Silk Roads tour. Okay. But this is what most people will have come here today for my talk, I suppose, to see some of these great splendors and wonders. So behind me, the mosque in Samarkand, these incredibly beautiful, ornate buildings with the rich, characteristic lapis from Central Asia, these astonishingly wonderful buildings that we have very little reference point to. We don't think about them as being anything more than a sudden firework that went off some point in Central Asia that made it important. We can't really think why that happened or where that world went. It was a kind of brief moment in time when the Silk Roads came into being and they were never really important. Here, the Madrasa and Mosque in Herat in Western Afghanistan, a country which we normally associate with barbarism, violence, and so on and so forth. I promise you the poetry and the heartbreaking buildings and fiction works written in this region are spellbinding. That's maybe what we should learn about rather than the negative stuff. Or here behind me, the Ark Fortress in Bukhara in Uzbekistan, or here the walls of Khiva, also in Uzbekistan. These are places that are adventurous places to visit on holiday. You don't go there when you could go to the south of France. You go there to go off the beaten track and to see this wonderful world that once suddenly, like I said, became important and then stopped being so important. Here, this is the cover of my book, the inside of the Shah Mosque in Isfahan. My wife told me never ever put a picture of yourself in a slideshow, but you know she's not here, even though his sister is and my children. So this was me talking in Sydney a while ago, just to show how important it is to get a sense of the scale of some of these things. Now that world that we learn about, that I'm talking to you about now, the Silk Roads, is irrelevant, which is wonderful why you're here, by the way. It's irrelevant. And I know it's irrelevant because although we talk about here the camels and the Sogdians, people have heard of their name maybe, or these wonderful silks, one here on my left, 1,500 years old, we think of this as being a series of networks that sort of really led to nowhere. It's about the geography, it's about crossing of deserts, it's something that we find difficult to really think of it as being important. And I know it's not important because when I was at school, and my children who are here today are at school, they didn't learn anything about the Silk Roads region. This is what they learn about, this is what I learned about, this is what all of you would have learned about. You'd have started with the ancient Greeks, for no particular reason, I suppose. We could talk about that. You'd have then gone on to the Romans in Britain. This is here depicted behind me. You'd then have a thousand year gap where nothing happens. Nothing of any significance happens between the Romans arriving in Britain and the Battle of Hastings. I'm not joking. I mean, this is our history. This is the history that's important. Why we suddenly pick up the Battle of Hastings, the bit where, forget about Brexit, that's the bit where the Normans invaded us and changed our legal system into something that was functional and recognisable across the Mediterranean, that's our starting point. We then go on from the Norman Conquest to this guy. I studied Henry VIII and his wives, I don't know, four times at school, maybe five times at school. I still can't tell you whether he was a good king and a bad... I know he's a bad husband. Bad husband and also a bad king with Sir Henry VIII. And then things get a bit more interesting. The sort of the events start to come a little bit closer together. We go from Henry VIII to this guy. You all know who that is, the Duke of Wellington. My children, I've got twin girls here. They spent one term at their school studying the Duke of Wellington, the Battle of Waterloo. One term. I mean, it's important, this. And then we go on to what matters in history are all these kinds of people, the Battle of the Somme, the Franz Ferdinand. I asked a bunch of school leavers who this was behind me and why she made my list. Please put your hand up if you know who she is. Sorry, you can't see her. Fair enough. Trick question. Okay, not many hands, okay. That's Emmeline Pankhurst. Okay. Who's quite important. So you can all know that, maybe you wouldn't guess that that's Franz Ferdinand after a few donuts too many, but there is Emmeline Pankhurst, very important figure because despite the correct emphasis we put on equality today, women 100 years ago were not allowed to graduate from my own university. Women in Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan, not great beacons of human rights, incidentally, but women got the vote in those countries before they did here in Great Britain. But this is the recognisable story of our past. Children do learn about suffragettes and equality at school now, but this is the sort of thing which all of you will be familiar with. These are all faces and names and figures from Europe, and then the United States from about 1900 or 1850 onwards becomes part of the picture. But actually our worldview, what's important in history, is actually this, really. This is what we know about. Forget the Silk Roads, forget Sub-Saharan Africa, the Americas. The history that we learn, that we focus on, is the history of Europe. And in fact, it's not even the history of Europe, really. It's the history of this. So I'm going to do my hands again. So put your hand up if you can. I'm not going to shout. I'm not going to point. I promise you I won't point at you unless you're related to me. If you think you'd be able to name an Italian composer of music, put your hand up. I will point at you if you don't put your hand up, by the way. Or a German philosopher, a French novelist, a French artist. Okay, there we go. Spanish artist. Right. Can anybody name me any Russian contemporary artist? Any Chinese novelist? Okay, I told you you're the cleverest audience they've had at the festival here, okay. Can anybody name me an important figure in Persian art, poetry, literature? Okay, we got a few. Trust me, that is terrific, okay. But that's maybe 5% of the people here. Can anybody name me a contemporary Arabic? Who is the Arabic Justin Bieber? Can anybody tell me who is the biggest selling Russian contemporary stuff? Russian, Arab, Chinese pop stars. Okay, but you've all heard of Justin Bieber. You may not be familiar with his oeuvre. You may not put him on your radio, but you've heard of him, right? Our world vision is restricted into this perpetuating story of what's important. And it's no irony, I think, that at the moment we're talking about the history of Europe and the European Union. But actually, if I ask you those questions about who's Bulgaria's national poet, or who are the great novelists from Poland or Belarus or Ukraine, we don't think that's important because it's not part of our educational background, and it's not something that was ever significant in the world we learn about. And in fact, if I were to ask an even more simple question, can anybody name me, just give me the name of one Chinese emperor, not even the greatest one. Can anybody name a single Chinese emperor in this tent? Okay, we've got a few, but still, I'd say that we're at 10% level maximum. Okay, our world is tied together by this story of the West. And from my point of view, the part of the world that I'm more interested in, that I think is more significant, is not this world where we borrow that ancient Greek and that Roman cultural legacy. So here are buildings from Chatsworth, obviously. The Jefferson Memorial in Washington, here in Liverpool, and I've just been out in Sydney. We design our buildings here to link us back to the classical world of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, because we don't want to address the fact that for 1,000 years, at least, that 1,000 years that's missing, where nothing happens, the world was irrelevant. The world outside that was moving on was irrelevant. So in my university at Oxford, we have the Museum of Natural History. And on the wall there, there are 27 busts of the world's greatest scientists, all people who you'd know, Galileo, Euclid, Charles Darwin, etc., etc. And one obvious gap in that is that there's not a single woman amongst those 27, which is interesting. That's a talk maybe they'll invite me back for next year. Amanda Foreman can talk about that. Important question, an important observation. But there's not a single scientist in the pantheon of scientists recognized by one of the world's greatest educational institutions that's not European. There's not a single Arab world, Persian, Indian, or Chinese scientist. And that tells me that we are disconnected not just from the world around us, that tells me we're disconnected from reality. That tells me that that story we tell of the past of focusing on a king with too many wives or on a king who got an arrow in his eye, or did he? Probably didn't, actually. That's another talk I'll offer for next year as a medievalist. It looks to me that the part of the world that's most interesting that anybody would want to try and study is this bit. I don't think I've got a pointer on it, but this, oh yes, I do. This bit here in the middle. Very unpromising, really. No one would think that anywhere around here is important, but just looking at the heart of the world, the bit where everything connects together, is obviously the most interesting one, because I know we all know that on an individual level, that the best, the times we learn are when we're surrounded by the most people. When we go on holiday and meet people who are different to us, have different opinions, different views, we learn from sharing. We learn tastes that way, we learn languages that way, we learn about each other's beliefs, we learn about other people's football teams, everything. The richness of our species, I think, comes from the fact that we are able to communicate and we're curious. We have a dog who's definitely not curious about anything or clever, but the difference between us and the animal and the rest of the animal kingdom is our willingness to try and to learn. And the place where that learning and activity has been, and the exchange has been at its most intense, has been in this part of the world. And we kind of know that, actually. All of you know that. I don't know if there's any professors of linguistics here, but you will all, unless you are professors of linguistics and really know what it means, we all sort of know that English and most of the European languages, except for Finnish and Hungarian, are Indo-European. We all know that there is some form of migration that comes, it's an awful word to use at the moment, or to admit to, that comes from east to west. We know that there are migrations of the great tribes like the Germans, who still can't lose on penalties even if they try, the Franks, the Goths, the Huns, the Magyars, these movements of people also from the east. This area, when I fly to the United States for what's now become a deeply unpleasant immigration exercise at passport control, I tick a box that says I'm of Caucasian origin. I define my ethnicity by the fact that from this mountain range here, no particular obvious reason, I suppose, apart from the fact that there is a proper knowledge somewhere that we are connected to this part of the world. And it's obvious why. I mean, this is where the Garden of Eden was thought to be here. This is where the first cities, this is where civilization actually began. The first cities, the first laws, the first tax codes were all things that started here in this heart of the world, as people learnt how to go from hunting and gathering to cooperating in more sophisticated ways. And I suppose as a boy growing up, the thing that struck me most was learning about Alexander the Great, who is a terrific thing to learn about as a young boy contemplating global domination, is that it never occurred to Alexander the Great that to conquer the known world involved turning towards Europe. Europe offered nothing to the Greeks. There were some small-scale settlements in places like Syracuse along the coast of what's now Croatia. But for the Greek world was entirely oriented on its neighbours, its relations, what lay beyond here in this part of the world. And it's not just the ancient Greeks who were configured that way. Herodotus was nothing other than a historian of the Silk Roads, as a friend of mine put it the other day, who might even be here. But even ancient Rome, we think of Rome being connected somehow because of Asterix and those Romans in Britain and the awful letters written back from Hadrian's Wall and from all over Britain saying how ghastly the experience was in this poisonous wind and the awful rain that we've had this last week. And also that late antiquity, they write about the British, saying Brutus, this word Britain comes from the Latin Brutus. They're people who react very badly in a political crisis. They are very hasty to attack each other rather than cooperating. These are all my words, by the way, luckily. But we think that Rome is sort of somehow a European thing because of the European Union, because of Europe, what it means, because of Gladiator, because of Asterix, because of all these things. But Rome's real heart was here in the East. Rome literally went from being a republic to an empire through the conquest here of Egypt, of the Nile Delta in particular. Rome's richest provinces were those of North Africa, and its prestige lay in its enemy here, the Parthians, the Persians here on the eastern frontier. And so important was that East as an economic thoroughfare, where huge amounts of trade, silks, ceramics, precious metals, foodstuffs, all brought from the East. Cicero thought that the East, that Asia, was all about lazy living. People could just sit back and money fell into their mouths. It was a land of luxury where people didn't have to work for a living, whereas here in Europe, you really had to roll your sleeves up and get down to it. There was real jealousy, envy, about the fact that everything in the East looked like it was so very wealthy. And such was Rome's need, I think, to get closer to those big trading routes, get closer to its military rivals, its prestige enemies and corporations, where they could learn about sciences and so on and so forth, eventually came to building a new city called New Rome. It shifted Rome from here, on the shin of Italy, to here. New Rome was quickly called after the man who refounded it, the Emperor Constantine, Constantinople. And when the Western provinces were eventually overrun by the Goths and the Vandals and so on and so forth, the Roman Empire carried on going. Based here in Constantinople with a Roman emperor, called himself the Emperor of the Romans, it carries on till 1453. But for reasons of our own mythologies, we've changed the name of that Roman Empire to call them the Byzantines. And Byzantines, as those of you will know, here is a highly pejorative term. I have Google alerts every time, I don't know why, it's conservative MPs misuse it by a factor. Well, there aren't anyone who talks in the House of Commons at the moment anyway, but the Conservatives talk about use the word Byzantine constantly to mean administrative chaos, overcomplicated, over-elaborate smoke and mirrors. This word actually should mean absolutely the opposite. This was a multilingual, multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multicultural, I'm not going to say like the European Union anymore, but was a world that required a real skill to administer it to last for more than 1,000 years. But we use this word because we don't want to engage with the fact that the East was once the most important part. The most important parts of Europe were not this Western part, this rich part that has controlled and dominated the world for the last 300 or 400 years. You know, 100 years ago, even Belgium had an empire, for goodness sake. But once upon a time, the rich and the important works of art, the biggest buildings, were being built in Pula, in Porrec, in Rovin, in Venice, in Split, where the Emperor Diocletian retired under the pressure. Like Tony Blair, he quit when it got tough, or Boris Johnson when he quit when it got tough, to go and grow cabbages because the pressure of rule was too great for him. Probably not Boris, he quit before then. But this eastern part of the empire, of Europe, was the most important one because it was connected to these big routes that spanned across Asia. And we know how important it is because all of our global religions come from this area here. You know, we might not think that those of you who been to church this morning heard the vicar preach, you know, would be very proud that there's something fundamentally British about Christianity because we write great hymns as well and these kinds of things. But Christianity is born, of course, from Judaism. Jesus Christ speaking Aramaic, a Semitic language, as you all know, although almost my favorite single story about politicians was a Texan senator who, when they were debating about 10 years ago about whether Mexican or Spanish should be taught as a compulsory second language in schools because of so many people coming from Mexico, stood up in front of the Texas Senate and said, if the English language was good enough for our Lord Jesus Christ, it should be it should be good enough for those guys who come south of the border. Our religions all spring from here. Even Islam, which, of course, its spiritual home in Mecca, once the followers of Muhammad start to expand, the heart, the engine room of the new, vibrant Muslim world is in cities like Damascus, Aleppo, Mosul, and eventually the great city of Baghdad. And this is where religions all borrow from each other. They compete, they jostle, they sometimes cooperate. But Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, and Zoroastrianism, these great religions, all fight for hearts and minds and souls, not always with their swords, but for competition, because it matters to all of us why we're here on Earth. You know, salvation and why we should treat each other properly, what happens in the afterlife, why should we behave well towards each other and treat each other with dignity? Why should we do that? And philosophers and theologians tend to be preoccupied with these kinds of questions about trying to bring out the best in our human condition. But this is where our languages come from as well. So those of you, again, maybe there are some linguistic specialists in here, the great language groups of Indo-European, the Sino-Tibetan languages of China and Southeast Asia, the Altaic languages of the steppe peoples, the deeply complicated languages, well, the Caucasus, and the Semitic languages all borrow and compete with each other. And that's why important loanwords are consistent across all of the major language groups, because when you need to drink water or to know what the sun is, we need to find a way of talking to each other, of sharing things. And the intensity of human exchange from, well, Barry Cunliffe would say from 20,000 BC, my book isn't as ambitious as his, by the way, I only start in 500 BC, is that all of that intensive communication is here. And until about the year 1500, when Henry VIII got going, until then, the equivalent of the Chalk Valley History Festival would have been held in Bukhara, or maybe in Isfahan, or maybe in Samarkand. This is where the world's great scholars were based. This is where the world's great mathematicians, philosophers, artists, everything sprung from here from 2,000, 3,000 BC until very, very recently. And that rise of Europe in those terms looks like an anomaly, looks complicated. And it doesn't look just complicated to me, it looked complicated to people writing in this world 1,000 years ago. The great Arab geographers were very keen on describing the whole world. It was a great sign of learning then, as it is for us here in the West, to be learned. That's why we academics are treated with red carpets and paid so much, like footballers. I'm joking, by the way, just in case you're checking. And they describe all the regions of the world. And one of my favorites, a beautiful text by Mukaddasi, explains all the different peoples of the world. And he reaches Europe and says, there's just no point me wasting any paper on these guys. Because they are not interested in scholarship. They're not interested in culture. They are good at creating weapons and killing each other. But there is nothing that they offer to the human experience that is of value to us. And one of his near contemporaries, another writer called Masudi, gives a response to this. It troubled the Arabs. They used to write and say, how is it that this world that gave us Ptolemy and Euclid, Aristotle, that were hugely revered in Arabic-speaking countries, and that's how we have these texts, by the way, they survived through transmission from the East, how is it they've descended into something that is so uncurious? And we find a neat answer for that in St. Augustine, one of the great church fathers, who says, it is not man's job on earth to question what God has created for us. You shouldn't waste your time on intellectual investigation. You should accept what there is. So that fundamentalist world where religion and God meant everything, interpreted by a small handful of men, versus a curious, polymathematic, wealthy world, of course, over the last 500 years has switched to be day and night. And there's good news, I promise, towards the end of it. But our experience with this part of the world in Europe, in that 1,000 years that we miss out, is complex. And it is unknown. This is the danger if you don't even study your own history properly, because we cherry-pick from the West what's interesting and what's important. So I mentioned at the beginning about things going in both directions. When the followers of Muhammad conquered this area in green within the few decades after his death, it took the most important and richest provinces of Rome and stuck them together with the richest provinces of what's now Iran, Persia, and beyond. And it was like switching on a jet engine. Cash flowed back into these cities. I mentioned some already: Mosul, Damascus, Basra, Kufa. Where is it? Nishapur, Herat. Merv, 1,000 years ago, was probably the biggest, most inhabited city in the world. I'm sure some of you will have been there because, like I said, you're a highly erudite audience. But a city in Turkmenistan that no one's really heard of today was once the leading center of the world for trade, for communication, for scholarship, etc., and so on. And this world had everything going for it, because we know that, as we know today, we're confronting today, declines in prosperity are analogous with declining tolerances. When you're rich, you can afford to be generous. You can afford to fund scholars. You can afford to allow people to, you can be confident, I suppose, rather than afford, you can be confident to allow other people to speak different languages and practice different faiths. And I think there is something in, clearly, the economic compression of Europe right now, at this particular moment in time. I think it's much longer than over the last few months or even over the last decade, much longer traction, that one of the reasons why we're having these kind of poisonous discussions, whichever side one is of the debate about Europe and so on, is the realization that life for our children is going to be harder than it has been for us. And the life for our grandchildren will be harder still. And that world of contraction is leads to volatilities and fragilities, right, which we're seeing played out in front of us, however that's going to end. But at this time, when Western Europe had nothing to offer, the question is, how could you engage with the money bags east that had lots of products and huge markets able to pay for them? And people in Europe tried selling everything, amber, swords, falcons. But the single most important product that we had in large quantities between the year, 750, for the next two or three centuries, were our women and children. We don't know about this because we don't think it's important to study it or to teach it. But some of the greatest cities in Europe began their lives as slaving centres. Dublin, Utrecht, Mainz, Verdun, Marseille, and most important of all, Venice. These were all cities that were on a controlled by traders exporting particularly women and children, but also young men, to the markets in the East. And we know that because there are huge numbers of texts talking about medieval slavery, huge numbers of texts in the Arab and Turkish world that describe how to buy a good slave, much like you'd buy a magazine today about what car to buy or what kind of laptop. They'd explain the benefits of slaves who were twins, benefits of having slaves who are eunuchs, particularly avoid floppy-haired, good-looking men who are useless around the house if they come from Southern Europe because all they do is pinch the bottom of the lady of the house. So don't buy those. These are not my words, by the way. It's all in my book. But the best thing about it is that historians have to be suspicious of their sources, much like you have to take all information. We know that. What you read on the internet, what you read in the papers, you have to know how to read it and what's being missed out and what's the context behind it. So what historians like me love are, of course, the written sources, but above all, we go mad for archaeology and for data-based sources. And the best data we have is from Russia, because although we get taught that the Vikings came and sacked Lindisfarne and they're all rapists and pillagers, and all we worry about is did they have horned helmets or not, the most important thing that the Vikings did was to build these trade connections here in blue and in red across down the river systems of Russia to transport their slaves. And along these river systems, we find silver coins from the Islamic world, not numbering in their thousands, or their tens of thousands, or their hundreds of thousands, or their millions, or even their tens of millions, but in the statistical modeling, in their hundreds of millions. The scale of human trafficking was huge. And I can show you how huge it is because some of you will be going to Italy this summer, when you go into a cocktail bar and say ciao to the waiter, you probably don't give a great deal of thought to what ciao means. It just means hi. Ciao is, in fact, from the Venetian slang, schiavo, I'm your slave. That's a kind of joke, because Venice, like the Pope, constantly tried to stop the Venetians selling people into slavery. It was a joke to pretend you were somebody's slave. And this part of the world, that if you draw that line up from Venice, more or less, eastwards, so important was this world to this network of human trafficking that the Pope eventually said it was forbidden to sell Christians to the Muslim people. That was absolutely wrong. But absolutely fine, all these guys on this side of the line who hadn't been Christianized through the fault of evangelism, and the name of these people who lie broadly to the east of this line today still gives its name to the word slave. The Slavs. Right? So this is actually the history of Europe that is more interesting, how we connect into different parts of the world. And these networks, these exchange mechanisms, are vital, not just for transmission of goods. They carry disease and pathogens. On the map behind me, I have the process of the Black Death, a bacterium that rises in the plague foci of Central Asia and then catches fire. Is brought by traders, brought by evangelists, brought by missionaries, brought by wanderers, brought by goods that eventually ends up killing at least a quarter of the population of Europe and more besides. They travel almost along exactly the same routes as the Mongols. The Mongols, by the way, like the Byzantines, suffer from terrible PR. That's what happens if you don't write history properly. The Mongols, who, although again we think of as being I don't know why they're considered right-wing, but anyway, right, you're to the right of Genghis Khan, as though that somehow, I don't know what that means. But anyway, the Mongols also, despite having a very formidable military presence, over the course, after they've done their 30 years of conquest, sit across a world of these networks that is tolerant. It's tax progressive, so I mean, it is conservative in terms of its government. They're very sensitive about taxing and price sensitivities. And this world knits together. We change their name when they come down to central to northern India. We call them Mughal because that sounds a bit more jolly rather than Mongol. But this is all Central Asian. But these networks start to change, not because of Henry VIII, but because of the man who he picks a fight with, actually. The man he picks a fight with is his wife's nephew, Charles V, who in the course of his lifetime goes from being a bit part Spanish monarch to the richest man in the world, as a result of the discovery of bullion in the Americas. And at the same time as Columbus and his successors finding trade routes across the Atlantic, the Portuguese find a way around the southern tip of Africa to India. And suddenly, Europe is in the forefront of connecting continents together. Instead of being at the wrong end of global trade networks, it sits right in the middle, the place that it's held ever since. We rise then as a financial center, and also even in 1500 and 1600, as a clearinghouse for dodgy money. So the money that's taken out of, South America in a mine called Potosí in Bolivia, that's still the single biggest single strike in human history, that money, rather than the gold and the silver start originally to come back to Seville and to London and Amsterdam, but eventually they come in more efficient routes across the Pacific, and they start to flood. As our standards of living start to rise, of course, because we're getting all access to all this money, so do the standards of living start to rise in places that suddenly have many new buyers. All the people in Britain who want to buy spices, silks, luxuries, ceramics from the East flood the coffers of rulers in India and in China and so on. And I think it's no coincidence that this, the jewel of India, I suppose one of the many jewels of India, the Taj Mahal, is built by a ruler paid for by silver that's come from Columbus's Indians in South America. Because Columbus wasn't trying to see if the world was flat, like I've explained to my son, or try to see if there was anything there, like I've also explained to my other son. He was trying to find routes to China and to India, because Europe and Western Europe was in the wrong location. So this world has always been important. It hasn't risen and fallen. It hasn't been out of the way. We just have never bothered to look at it, because we teach our children at schools, well, if you're lucky, maybe Latin or French. If you're really lucky, Greek, but that's dying. German, if you're lucky. Spanish, maybe Italian. But no one learns Arabic. Very few learn Russian. Mandarin is sort of becoming a thing to do and to say that we teach. But this world is one which we've never bothered to look at their past because it was not important in history. I suppose because, you could put it crudely, their loss was our gain. By taking over control of these trade networks, by finding a way of replacing and in some ways controlling, because of course the East India Company that arrives to come and trade in India eventually becomes the origins of a colonizing power. But everything you look at in world history, everything you look at that's important, somehow connects back into this heart of the world. Even here, I've got behind me William Knox Darcy, who is an Australian solicitor who, through a fluke of investment, hit gold in Mount Morgan in South Australia, in Queensland, and as a result became one of the richest men in the world. And his money was used, encouraged by the British government, to help exploit Persian oil, which was discovered in 1907. And his investment was eventually bought by the British government after Franz Ferdinand had been shot, but before the start of the First World War, so that British Admiralty knew that our ships could stay out at sea for the whole duration of a war, no matter how long it would last, and then eventually gave birth here to BP. So BP is itself the creation of a series of connections that link Australia, Iran, oil revenues, rivalries with Germany, and competition, which I talked about a bit about those of you there on Friday, intense competition in the 19th century with Russia for control of those central hearts of the world, where paranoia in London about what the Russians were up to, well-founded, in fact, about that Britain's buffer had been reduced to the thinness of a wafer in the case of India. The anxieties that we would lose our position, our trading powers. And even here, you know, this week we've been the solemn and very moving celebrations, or commemorations, I should say, of the Battle of the Somme. We would all of us think that the 20th century really is defined by the First and the Second World Wars and then by communism. But in many ways, the story of the 20th and certainly the 21st century has also been, at least as important, control of these oil pipelines, control of Iran in the time of the Shah and immediately afterwards, control of Iraq and of Central Asia, Afghanistan. These are the areas of the world that are hugely problematic to us, where we in the West are paying the price for our absolute failure to have bothered to try to understand these people and to work out how to communicate with them and to work with them and deal with them. And for me, if I was teaching my children, well, which I do, they'll tell you about it. You can ask them questions after this, not me. These are the countries in the world where tomorrow is going to be better than today. Okay? This was before the Brexit vote. But you'll notice that there's not a single one of these that's in the Western Hemisphere. These countries are going to grow. There are lots of good reasons for it, some starting from low points. But these are the areas where there are opportunities for our children one day. What those will be, who knows. But also, this is the region where the change of the last, whatever it is, 30 years, the way we teach history hasn't changed. So since I was at school, the Berlin Wall came down. China's economy has quadrupled in size since the Royal Bank of Scotland first admitted it was defrauding its customers. We now have train lines that link Western China with Iran and with the Caucasus. Aleppo and the Middle East, we all shake our head and say it's impossible to know what to do about it. Here, I've just been in central Kazakhstan, Astana, a city that was properly built, founded in 1997. That, I mean, it's just astonishing. This is one of their shopping centres, which has a beach resort on the top. Here, the president of Turkmenistan, working out with dumbbells. They may just be polystyrene. Who knows? But Turkmenistan, nobody gives too much thought about, sit on top of the third largest natural gas reserves in the world, and they have a population 10 times the size of Iceland, so 4 million people. So they'll probably beat us at football too, eventually. And of course, apartheid has ended. And that story of the Romans in Britain, Henry VIII, Battle of Waterloo, First World War, what is the point teaching this if this is the world that is real? So those of you who haven't got my book, buy one for your. Honestly, I'm doing well enough. It's great. I'm very grateful. But this is a world that you're. This is. I'm being properly. I'm an educator. I'm not selling anything. Apart from this is a world that your children, your grandchildren, your nieces and nephews need to understand. They need to understand, even with the problems of Brexit going on, because this is what I think is actually important in the world. In some way, it doesn't really matter whether it's Theresa May or Michael Gove. It doesn't matter how we exit the European Union. The world will keep spinning. But this stuff actually matters. Okay, so, and this is the part of the world that I work on, that no one else wants to look at because it's exotic, it's peripheral, and you can now, if you wrote a book about it, no one will buy it, they said, and now, of course, that sort of this ruins my story a bit. But, you know, the Ukraine, Turkey, you know, who knows what's going to happen in the coming years, already being torn away from Europe, facing eastwards. I mean, I don't even need to tell you where all these places are. But these are just the confrontation flashpoints where the cost to us is huge. Some scholars at Harvard did some work, rather, on the cost of the intervention in Iraq. And what was expensive there, of course, was the loss of lives and the horrors and the reputational damage, the price, what it did to the oil, what it did to the stock market. But the single greatest cost of the Iraq intervention is the fact there are now 170,000 US servicemen who are 70% or more disabled. And the cost in the long term to the US government of paying for their medical needs is somewhere in the region of $7 to $8 trillion. So these interventions, when we have the Chilcot report coming out this week, when you make decisions based on profound ignorance, on ideas that you think are look good on paper, where you go into things where you don't have a plan, that sounds familiar this week as well, there are consequences to game playing. And there are consequences to not investing enough in the education system and not insisting that our curriculum allows us to encourage study of regions and peoples that actually do matter for both for bad and for good. And we are alone like this. Here, the president of China, Xi Jinping, in Astana, in Kazakhstan, in 2013, gave a speech where he talked about the new Silk Roads to be built, the One Road, One Belt initiative. And this is what is currently happening across the world in real times. China so far has committed $1 trillion to infrastructure projects across the spine of Asia. We've been doing some work on one of the many corridors that's linking China with through Pakistan, called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan, over the last decade, has had some around about between $1 and $3 billion a year in foreign direct investment. It's currently receiving $46 billion before 2020. What that will mean for its relations with Iran, what it will mean for its relations with India, what it means for relations with Kashmir or what happens to Kashmir, what this world that is emerging around us is happening while we focus on the corridors of power in Whitehall. And this world is connecting and working out, while I'm not going to compare it with the European Union because it's trite, but a world that is working out how to deepen its corporations, how to overlook national differences, how to cooperate together. And last week, it was no coincidence in timing that the leaders of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the presence of Russia, China, the Central Asian Republics, Iran, and so on, India were there too, Europe wasn't mentioned. Because Europe, in this world, where oil needs, China's energy needs are likely to treble in the next 15 years, China already consumes 50% of the world's pigs, so even if they stop building their cities quite as fast as they've been doing, and the new normal is a slowdown, consumption of foodstuffs as demographic growth changes will affect all of us. In the next 30 years, the world population will grow by 1.5 billion people, and only 50 million of that will be in the Western Hemisphere. 1.5 billion more mouths to feed here. So who grows things? Who has natural resources? Who has pipelines that can deliver oil, gas, and so on? What is the impact of clean technology going to do? The current urban plan for Beijing is to anticipate a city that will eventually be able to host 100 million population. China's current economic cycle is not like ours. When do we trigger Article 50? China's current economic cycle runs through to 2049. And when you're able to try and plan over the long term like that, you break the eggs for your omelette in a slightly different way. So the Silk Roads that I'm talking about in my book is where this sort of thing is important. These are current roads, and roads, train lines, pipelines, all knitting together. There are more, by the way, in Europe than just this, because everyone is incentivized to get the best price. Europe is not out of the picture. But this world that is vibrant, that is coming alive again, looks to me like the world looked like before the discovery of a route to India and before Columbus's crossing of the Atlantic. Because for a lot longer in human history than not, Europe has been peripheral. And my own view, for what it's worth, is not that Europe is going to shrink, but this world is going to grow, and it's going to keep on growing.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.